from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. The United States has a weapon in SEAL Team 6, the agile, lethal, super-secret special ops team that killed Osama bin Laden. They've been given license to spy, license to kill, and the capacity to do it with out-of-nowhere suddenness. A new investigative report by the New York Times details how the elite group of fighters became a global manhunting machine. With that comes questions about their use and deployment, where they take American force projection. This hour on Point, the secret history of the U.S. Navy's SEAL Team 6 and the dark art of their special ops. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. How much, how often should this crew be deployed with deadly force? Are they a good alternative to an army of boots on the ground? What should we use these special ops for? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. For most Americans, SEAL Team 6 became household word phrase in May of 2001. Here's President Barack Obama announcing the death of the United States' most wanted terrorist leader, Osama bin Laden, from the White House.
Tonight, I can report to the American people and to the world that the United States has conducted an operation that killed Osama bin Laden, the leader of al-Qaeda, and a terrorist who's responsible for the murder of thousands of innocent men, women, and children.
Of course, I misspoke. That's 2011, the president reporting there. Here's one of those who was on the mission, Robert O'Neill, ex-Navy SEAL, who says he shot Osama bin Laden. This is debated. It's controversial. But here he is talking with CNN in November 2014, last year.
The doorway led to a bedroom, and in the bedroom was Osama bin Laden a matter of feet in front of me. And he had his hands on his wife's shoulders. He was not surrendering. He was sort of moving, and just based on the level of threat of him not surrendering and the likelihood of him having a vest, I engaged him. I shot him twice in the head. He fell on the floor. I shot him one more time, and I killed him.
A rare voice out of SEAL Team 6. Here's another former SEAL Team 6 member, known by the pseudonym Mark Owen, talking about the raid that killed Osama bin Laden. This is from a 2013 interview with Scott Pelley on CBS's 60 Minutes. When SEAL Team 6 returned to the United States, President Obama asked which of the SEALs had killed bin Laden.
He asked who was the one, and we told him we wouldn't tell him.
You wouldn't tell him? Why not?
Pulling a trigger is easy. You know, a couple pounds of pressure in your trigger finger, and I've done it millions of times, and it's not that hard. You know, so it's not about who that one person was. It's who, it was about the team or the helicopter pilots or the intel folks that teed this whole thing up. Who cares who the one person is? Doesn't matter.
Who pulled the trigger on Osama bin Laden? A small question compared to the very large ones and big issues raised in an enormous piece of reporting that appeared Sunday in the New York Times. Joining us now is New York Times correspondent Nick Kulish. He spent a year working with Times reporters Mark Mazzetti, Christopher Drew, Serge Kovaleski, Sean D. Taylor, and John Ismay reporting the big piece that ran yesterday in the Times, headlined SEAL Team 6, A Secret History of Quiet Killings and Blurred Lines. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Nick Kulish, welcome back to On Point. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Good to be here, Tom.
And first of all, I should say, what a big investment of reporting clearly went into this, and I'm glad that you're out there and able to do that. Who did you talk to put this big report together? I've read more detail here than I've ever read before on SEAL Team 6. Who's talking?
Well, as you see in the story, many of the people who are talking are speaking on background, but we ultimately ended up reaching dozens of current and former members of SEAL Team 6 over the course of kind of a long year of methodically sort of going to people and explaining what we were doing and sort of getting a chance to sit down with them.
You call it a global manhunting machine. Justify that label.
Sure. I mean, clearly in Iraq and Afghanistan, especially Afghanistan for SEAL Team 6, as well as taking part in the hunt for al-Awlaki in Yemen, going after members of al-Shabaab in Somalia. It's really grown to the point where, if we have an enemy, doesn't seem to matter so much where they are in a lot of instances. You know, we go after them and try to take them out.
Remind us of the basics, if you'd be good enough, Nicholas. Where does SEAL Team 6 sit within the U.S. military? Is it all the SEALs, part of the SEALs? Who joins it? How big is it? Give us the basics, if you would.
Sure. It's a little confusing because, of course, you have Navy SEALs like Chris Kyle, who everyone knows from the book and the movie American Sniper. Mm-hmm. Those are special operations forces of the Navy. And then SEAL Team 6 is the sort of elite within the Navy SEALs. And so although in some ways they answer to the Naval Special Warfare Command in San Diego, operationally they fall under what's called JSOC, or the Joint Special Operations Command. And that's really where the most secretive military operations that we do are sort of planned and executed, and that includes SEAL Team 6 as well as the Army's Delta Force and Army Rangers as well. And they do a lot of work, interchangeably and together.
When I looked at the volume and frequency in some periods of killing that is described in your piece, I was kind of astonished to be reminded of the rather small number. SEAL Team 6 only includes 300 assault troops. You call them operators, they do. 1,500 support personnel, but that's just 300 who hit the field.
Exactly. They liken themselves to the 300 Spartans. It's quite a lot for these guys. And one of the things that you really saw, I think that some members, I mean, you know, they like to do what they do, and they consider themselves, the best in the world at it. But also, when they were in Afghanistan night after night going after low-level Taliban facilitators, there sometimes was a sense of, this is supposed to be the special mission unit that does the most elite tasks, and now we're just kind of, as one guy put it, turning into utility infielders with guns.
Remind us how that got started. This was after the invasion in Afghanistan. There were special challenges here, and they got called on. How that got started and what the tempo became of nightly killing by SEAL Team 6.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, what happens is that, we leave the Navy SEALs, we leave SEAL Team 6 in Afghanistan as things have really heated up in Iraq. And we're kind of, we don't have as many troops in Afghanistan as we might have if we hadn't opened the second war. And the Taliban begins making a comeback. And the question is, how do you fight them? Because they're not lining up in rows like the Redcoats in the American Revolutionary War to meet on a battlefield. They're mixing in with the civilian population. They're hiding. They're not uniformed. And so these night raids, collecting intelligence, trying to figure out where to go, and then kicking in the door or picking the lock or using an explosive breaching charge to get in, and then go through a darkened compound and try to find the find the bad guy, as it were, became, a really regular thing, something they were doing night after night.
Remind us, the first many people heard of this really explicitly was when it got all the way to Osama bin Laden. But you're describing here 10, 20 kills every single night, a kind of, and SEAL Team 6 members describing themselves being made fierce, made savage by this, killing in all kinds of ways. Right in the opening of your story, coming back so soaked in so much blood they didn't know whose it was. What was the top of the tempo?
Yeah, I think that really that sort of it begins in 2006 and kind of escalates into the 2009, 2010 period. Although you have this pushback where, then Afghan President Hamid Karzai is saying, these night raids are killing too many civilians. It's costing too many lives. It's turning the population of Afghanistan against the government and against the NATO coalition. I think that, the problem for them is that, you have these people blended into the population, and you're trying to figure out, how do we get them? And with our advances in night vision technology, the advantages that our special operations forces have in the dark makes that just, the best and the safest way for them to go.
Was that who Karzai was talking about when he made that very loud complaint? We all remember, he said, this has to stop. Was that all Surely that wasn't all SEAL Team 6. Were they that active over Afghanistan that they had the president of Afghanistan's attention so fiercely focused?
I mean, that would also have included a lot of Army Ranger raids. I mean, the Rangers and SEAL Team 6 were working together quite a bit at that time. But, you know, it's an interesting evolution because SEAL Team 6 had provided security for Karzai in the early going, right after September 11th or in 2002. And he really, you know, he was a big fan. He was very appreciative. And then, you know, over time, as their activities changed, you know, his thinking changed and he became a critic.
A critic there. That eventually wound down, but the capacity to go and go almost anywhere doesn't seem to have dipped at all. There's a change that you're describing here in how the United States understands its capacity and deploys it, this go anywhere, anytime, sort of into almost any circumstance and bring out a kill or intelligence. Is it changing the way the Pentagon understands power projection, Nick?
Yeah, no. I mean, I think it really has. You look back at the Cold War when the question was, you know, who could have the biggest toys, you know, the biggest missiles, the biggest tanks, you know, the best, you know, Top Gun jet fighters. And for the war that we've been fighting now since 9/11 against terrorists and militants who try actually to blur borders as much as possible to move in and out of different countries and different safe houses. You know, that is a different enemy, that, you know, a networked secret enemy. And people in the Pentagon will argue that we need our own secret forces to go after them.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about SEAL Team 6, super secret, super deadly, and in the last decade, increasingly, one of America's most important tools of war, of killing. The New York Times spent a year putting together a big background story on SEAL Team 6. Nicholas Kulish, one of the reporters on that story, ran yesterday, is with us today. You can link to the story at our website, onpointradio.org. Many Americans got to know them for the first time in 2011 when they killed Osama bin Laden. Feature film made about that, Zero Dark 30, chronicled that whole hunt. From the film, anyway, here's CIA agent Maya, played by Jessica Chastain, justifying the use of SEAL Team 6 to take down bin Laden when the team questions her intel.
Quite frankly, I didn't even want to use you guys. With your dip and your Velcro and all your gear, I wanted to drop a bomb.
But people didn't believe in this lead enough to drop a bomb. So they're using you guys as canaries in the theory that if bin Laden isn't there, you can sneak away and no one will be the wiser. But bin Laden is there, and you're going to kill him for me.
There's the Hollywood version, Zero Dark 30. Here's the real thing. Retired U.S. Army General Stanley McChrystal talking about the use of special operations in Afghanistan.
We would do, early in the war, we would do these wonderful special operations raids into an area where conventional force had responsibility. We'd hit this target. We'd do it great. We'd come back. We'd be very happy with ourselves. But the impact in that neighborhood and area had to be dealt with by the conventional force.
There were things to be dealt with, yes, in the aftermath. And it wasn't just Afghanistan. Here's former U.S. Navy Admiral William McRaven, who was then commander of U.S. Special Operations Command, talking about the need for special ops at the Aspen Security Forum in 2012 worldwide.
There is a whole spectrum of things that special operations do that rarely get the press's attention because it's not sexy. It doesn't sound terribly good or terribly bad at that point in time, but when you put the totality of it together, you have nations out there that have not gone extremist because special operations forces have been working there for decades.
Nicholas Kulish and a New York Times team spent a year looking at SEAL Team 6. Nick is talking with us today. Nick, there's several things I'd like to go to here. One is equipment. I mean, part of what they're supposed to do, their formal name has to do with testing equipment here. You talk about new guns, new grenades, new ways of warfare that SEAL Team 6 applies. Like what? What did you find?
Yeah, I mean, you know, as noted just now, you know, you think of the conventional forces, you know, holding a normal, they say suppressed now instead of silenced, instead of a silencer, you know, a suppressor that'll cut down on noise, that'll cut down on light, that then makes it easier to fight someone in the dark without them knowing
which
direction.
You're talking of the gun, the rifle.
Of the gun, excuse me, yes. Mm-hmm. And in fact, you know, I spoke with a hostage who was freed by them, and he said that he watched the hostage taker shooting in the completely opposite direction. So they were coming up behind him shooting, and he was shooting right away from them because he literally had no idea
where
they were.
Could not tell where the fire was coming from.
Could not tell where it was coming from.
It's a German gun they're using there. You talk about a grenade. Is it really a single grenade that brings down a whole building?
Yeah, well, what it doesn't bring it down as much through explode. It's through pressurization, so it kind of brings the roof down. And that's, you know, something where if you have a group of guys firing out of a building, and you can't necessarily pick them off one at a time, it would then be easier just to drop a thermobaric grenade through one of the windows.
Techniques, this so-called, I don't know how to pronounce this, hey-ho, high-altitude, high-opening parachuting, used how, with what effect, to do what?
Yeah, there's two sort of techniques. There's hey-ho, which is they jump and they open and they steer. They steer their way dozens of miles sometimes to the exact landing spot where they want to go. For instance, in the rescue of Jessica Buchanan, a U.S. hostage in Somalia, they used a hey-ho jump to get into unfriendly territory in Somalia to pull her and her Danish colleague out of there. It's incredibly complex and also difficult, and men have died just doing the training for it.
Describe some of these rescues, if you would, Nick. The hostages reported to you they were just dumbfounded. They'd be in the middle of an ordinary day as a hostage somewhere, Somalia or you name it, and they almost couldn't believe how quickly, suddenly, the SEALs would be there, their captors would be dead, and it would be over.
Yeah, I mean, everyone kind of describes the same, the suddenness and the just, one second you're living in one world, which is in the complete, control and power of the hostage taker, and the next second you're being whisked away to a helicopter and to freedom, at least in the successful cases. And then unfortunately, there have also been some cases even recently in Yemen, where the hostage takers, were able to kill the hostages before they got there.
There were times in their history when they got pretty, I'm not sure what the word is, funky. I mean, you heard Jessica Chastain in the movie talking about their dip and their gear, but you describe a top officer coming into a group of SEALs some years back and saying, "What is this? Pirates of the Caribbean, the long hair and the earrings," and it was kind of a culture unto itself.
Yeah, this notion of modified grooming standards is the nice way of putting it. But growing the hair out, growing the beard out, which is meant to sort of allow someone to fit into a civilian population, or not necessarily look like a guy with a crew cut who is instantly identifiable as a soldier. I think now there's actually kind of been a shift where this kind of heavily tattooed guy with long hair and a beard is very much associated with U.S. special operations at this stage. But that's kind of, I think, a mark of pride. You're saying I'm elite. I don't have to do the shoe polish and the razor.
The quiet killings in your headline, we get, you describe that period where it was 10 to 15 kills on many nights, sometimes up to 25. Lots of different kinds of weaponry here, including tomahawks made by the same guy who made them for The Last of the Mohicans, the film, which I guess have become a kind of a symbol for some in SEAL Team 6. You also talk in the headline about blurred lines. Now, I heard you talking about terrorists blurring borders, and that's clearly evident. What are the blurred lines that you found here when it comes to what, Nick, around SEAL Team 6?
Sure. I mean, there's definitely the blurred lines of the borders. You see missions into Pakistan that we hadn't previously heard about, but that they, before the bin Laden raid, which obviously, made that famous, but it wasn't actually a singular event. I think the biggest blurred line that we see is the line between soldiering. I mean, technically Navy SEALs are in the Navy, so they're not soldiers, but soldiering in the traditional sense that we think of it, and spying, that they've assumed very much an espionage role in some ways with their black squadron, which went from being snipers to being, advanced force operations, people working out of embassies, laying groundwork for operations, picking up intel, kind of preparing for that global mission.
When the New York Times puts blurred lines on a huge piece on page one about SEAL Team 6, it sort of suggests blurred lines to having to do with law of war or legality. What did you find there, if anything?
Well, I mean, I think when you talk, you know, in some instances about the national boundaries, you know, there's you have guys that, you know, they call it sheep dipping when a soldier is kind of is tasked over to the CIA, and then they operate under the intelligence authority. So, for instance, we learned a great deal about the Omega program, where SEAL Team 6 was working with the CIA and local forces to kind of get beyond their own mandate, which in the early years of the Afghan war was to kill al-Qaeda in Afghanistan when al-Qaeda had almost entirely evacuated Afghanistan. So, you know, you find them playing this dual role that I think is one of the central issues that we're looking at, because the United States has moved more and more towards secrecy, you know, in surveillance, in the drone campaign, and now as well with using our special mission units as much as possible rather than the regular accountable forces. And that's something that we thought needed a close look.
And when it comes there, it's not just that they're doing spying, but as you say, they're under the CIA umbrella, which is a much more cloaking umbrella, where the same accountability doesn't exist. What concern did you find raised there? Are people worried that the U.S. is deploying lethal force, you know, out of the dark in an instant all over the world, sort of outside bounds of congressional oversight or legal authority?
Sure. I mean, you know, as one of our sources said, if you're unacknowledged on the battlefield, you're not accountable. And as another said, this is something where Congress just generally doesn't want to know. And I was really surprised by the number of times that I would reach out to people who talk about military matters on a regular basis. And they would say, I don't want my name used in association with Team 6, because it's, you know, it is meant to be secret. And I think that when you have a very small force used very, very infrequently, then the secrecy argument is easier to make. The bigger it gets, the more money it costs, the more missions that it goes on, the more you start to say, "This, you know, does this need more accountability along the lines of the regular forces?"
Eventually, you've got a different way of war. John in Monroe, North Carolina. John, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
My name, my son is a retired Navy SEAL.
Mm-hmm.
And my grandson is an active Navy SEAL.
Wow.
You know, I don't know if everybody would fight by the same rules, that would be fine.
Mm-hmm.
But if our adversaries, they deserve what they get, because that's the only way we can do it. And I just don't understand the legal aspect governing the rules of war that is totally unconventional. That's all I have. Thank you.
John, we've got it. Father of a Navy SEAL, grandfather of a Navy SEAL. And, Nick, there's pushback right there against the idea of too much oversight. It's unconventional. And, you know, it runs in John's family. He says we've got to do what we've got to do.
Right, and you know, and I think this idea of, you know, they're secret, we need to be secret, they're unconventional, we need to be unconventional. But on the other hand, you know, we also think see ourselves, you know, as being kind of morally, you know, above what they're doing. You know, we see them as terrorists, and we don't want to play a kind of at their level. You know, it's you know, there are some ideals that I think we as the United States, you know, try to live up to. And that's a question that I think we need to face. But one of the bigger issues here is we just, you know, we know so little that it's hard to even judge, that we can't even have the debate until we understand what we're debating about. And that's what I think we were attempting to do with this article.
Jerry in New Philadelphia, Ohio. Jerry, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
I got a comment about SEAL Team 6. They're a secretive elite group, and it should stay that way. I mean, people trying to expose them, find this and that and about them, they're not Americans. They're not Americans. Leave them be. Let them do their job. Thank you. God bless America.
Jerry, thank you for your call. Don't want to know. Let them do their thing. On the other hand, they'll do it in all Americans' names, and there's the conversation among Americans to be had. Jerry doesn't want to hear much, but he wants it secret. One more right here. Onalaska, Wisconsin. Frank, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
And as much as I'd rather see a group like this be used to affect our foreign policy rather than putting boots on the ground, my question there is, what happens to our legal and moral response when actions that the United States or Israel has taken using drones to take out suspected terrorists, when those same actions are turned upon U.S. leaders or civilians? What's our response going to be there? It's okay for us and Israel to do it, but if another country or terrorist does it against our U.S. citizens, is that acceptable?
In some ways, you could say terrorists, in some way, they already do it. When they come down on a meeting outside of in Texas in the night, you could see it right there. But sure, other nations, what would that feel like? It wouldn't feel too good. Frank, I appreciate your call. Nick Kulish, please stand by. A couple more very knowledgeable voices with us right now. First, from Houston, Texas, Jeffrey Korn is here, professor of criminal military law at the South Texas School of Law, retired U.S. Army lieutenant colonel. His last position was the Army's senior expert on law of war in the office of the Judge Advocate General JAG. Jeffrey Korn, thank you very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
And from Monterey, California, John Arquilla is with us, professor, chair of defense and analysis at the Naval Postgraduate School. His department looks closely, works with the Navy SEALs, specifically SEAL Team 6. He's author of Insurgents, Raiders, and Bandits, How Masters of Irregular Warfare Have Shaped Our World. John Arquilla, welcome back to On Point. You hear our caller in Wisconsin saying, if we do this, or we and the Israelis do this, what's to stop others from doing it, and how would we feel about that? Killing suddenly, from the dark, anywhere, anytime. What do you say, John?
Well, I'd say that there are over two dozen wars going on in the world today, and all of them look something like this. We call it irregular warfare, but that's all there is out there. And so you wonder, what's conventional war anymore? I think the challenge for most countries is to develop these capabilities for what a great German theorist of this called war out of the dark, very apt term, how to develop these capabilities, but to do so in an accountable way that allows for oversight. And I would say that my own experience these past decades has been that our special operations forces have a great deal of oversight and operate with a great deal of circumspection. If we're talking about which side of the laws of war we're on, we have to look at the whole range of military behavior. Abu Ghraib prison wasn't a very nice thing. Drone killings of civilians is a collateral damage problem that is mitigated but hasn't gone away. And so in any area of military activity, you're always going to have these kinds of questions.
Jeffrey Korn, we've just got a minute before the break here, but can we have war out of the dark, SEAL Team 6 style, and accountability?
Well, I think John's right. Not only can we have it, we do have it. And one of the aspects of the use of special operations forces that I think was a little bit overlooked in the story was the extent of legal oversight within the organization that is greater now than has ever existed before with special operations units. I know personally quite a few military lawyers who are military legal advisors in Special Operations Command, and I'm confident that no mission is planned or executed or reviewed without a robust involvement of legal oversight and operational legal experts who understand the laws of war and understand both the scope of authority and the limits of that authority that apply to these operations.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at WBUR.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about SEAL Team 6, super secret, super deadly, and in the last decade, increasingly one of America's most important tools of war. The New York Times with a big, big story yesterday, page upon page, reported by a half dozen of their reporters over the space of a year. One of them, Nicholas Kulish, joins us today from the New York Times. You can link to the full story at our website, onpointradio.org. Also with us today, John Arquilla, Chair of Defense and Analysis at the Naval Postgraduate School, works closely with Navy SEALs, specifically SEAL Team 6. Jeffrey Korn is with us from Houston, Texas, former high in JAG military operations. He's a retired U.S. Army Lieutenant Colonel now at the South Texas School of Law. Lots of response online here. Jeffrey, John, Nick Thinkin writes, all is fair in love and war. Maybe this is true. Writes, it's not like war is a sport where we have to be fair when we fight an enemy like ISIS. Why should we commit a whole army and all that entails if a small but deadly group can do serious damage to the enemy? Use drones if they work. Why give more lives to the bloodthirsty enemy? Chuck says maybe we should have used them in Iraq before the war. Would we have known if the intelligence we were assuming was right was correct or not? Krieger writes, secrecy should not be a free pass from accountability. And Michael writes on Twitter, how many other nations have operations like this in our territories? A little bit of the fairness idea coming back in there again. Let me go to Sandra calling from Franktown, Virginia. Sandra, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was wondering if this was discussed, how do they feel when they rescue a missionary and lose one of their own, which happened fairly recently? And I was also wondering, what did they think of Seymour Hersh's revelations?
Good, thank both. Thank you, Sandra. Nick Kulish, first, Seymour Hersh, who had a dispute of the whole story of Osama bin Laden's killing. Did you get a chance to bounce that telling off of Navy SEALs or their commanders?
I have. I would say, were fairly critical of Mr. Hersh's version of events, which I guess, you know, one would sort of expect. I mean, he, you know, he argues that people in the, you know, government have been trying to keep to cover up how it really happened. But also, if his account were correct, it would suggest that the Osama bin Laden raid, which really is the signature SEAL Team 6 mission, was actually, you know, aided and abetted by the Pakistani ISI, and therefore not as impressive as it seemed. So needless to say, there's been quite a bit of pushback toward the way that he described it.
And what about Sandra's question? When they lose one of their own in these missions, I mean, we know that hurts. And of course, when soldiers or SEALs fight together, it may hurt all the more. What did you see there? Some of the stories that you recount suggest a kind of bloodletting in response.
Well, I mean, first of all, they're, you know, these guys are incredibly, incredibly tight with one another, you know, incredibly close. And, you know, when someone dies in that kind of instance, you know, I think that obviously the normal kind of mourning comes into practice. But the question of whether then you see, you know, retribution or greater killing, we've heard that suggestion. It's very difficult, you know, in a darkened room, you know, in Kunar province in Afghanistan to know exactly what transpired. But I mean, certainly I think there is that reaction, you know, at times, but
you describe a rescue wherein I think one SEAL died and the hostage who was rescued ended up thinking that there was more death that night than there needed to be in the aftermath.
Sure. In the rescue of Dr. Dilip Joseph, he has described how one of the hostage takers, the youngest one of a young man, he saw him still alive after the raid, you know, in custody, and then saw him after that dead, having been shot. And just was asking the question of whether that was necessary, and that's also something, however, that, you know, U.S. Special Operations Command, you know, disputes that version of events.
They say he was disoriented. So, he was never back in there. He doesn't know.
And he in turn says, "I remember it clear as day." So there, you know, you have a different account, but it's very unusual to actually have, you know, an American citizen there for one of these missions to have any idea of what happened.
Camille in Charleston, South Carolina. Camille, you're on the air.
Hello. Thank you, Tom. I'm interested in how the International Criminal Court, the ICC, would or does perceive the Team 6, the SEALs.
Interesting question. Let us pick it up, Camille. Jeffrey Korn?
Yeah, I don't think that the International Criminal Court would be particularly focused on a particular military unit. First off, there are real complexities with the International Criminal Court's ability to even assert jurisdiction over U.S. military personnel because the United States is not a member of that court. It's a treaty-based court. And secondly, candidly, the International Criminal Court is focused on much more what we might call high levels of misconduct in war, genocide, widespread war crimes. And I think it's unlikely that they would particularly focus on any one mission of the SEALs. But more importantly, the International Criminal Court is a secondary accountability mechanism, and the treaty itself requires the court to allow the states to go through their own accountability process. And if there was evidence of an unlawful killing during a mission, then the military justice system in the organization itself would be the primary focal point of investigating and, if necessary, prosecuting that misconduct.
John Arquilla in Monterey, California, what comes to your mind when Camille asked the question about international law, the court, and SEAL Team 6?
Well, it's an issue that we're going to have to address as a global society. The arms race that we're all familiar with from the Cold War era is giving way to an organizational race to create military elites, but also to create terrorist and insurgent networks. 25 years ago, there were only 5 jihadi groups in the world. Today, there are 50. The fact that we have only 300 people in this particular unit suggests that maybe we're a little behind in the organizational race. Certainly these administrative matters are going to be discussed in international law because this is the kind of war that we're looking at for the future. The New York Times article does speak to the idea that this is a new kind of war. I just want to remind us all that it may be a rekindling of a very early American kind of war. The Rangers have their origins over 250 years ago, and they really transformed the whole British Army in North America to win that war against the French and to create the possibility of a United States.
Mm-hmm.
The Indian Wars were replete with these kinds of irregular operations, best conducted by General Crook. In our first encounters in the Philippines around the turn of the 20th century, a lot of this kind of raiding was going on. And even in the big wars, this happened as well. So we're rekindling something at which we were initially quite good in our history, and we're going to have to get very good again.
Of course, at this point we have equipment and transport in particular that could scarcely have been imagined in the Revolutionary War, and even much more recently. John, if this is the new way of war, and if we see fewer masses of boots on the ground and a lot more or more of these very deadly elites sort of dropping out of the dark, hitting very targeted targets and off they go, what does that mean? Can everybody play this game? Do we get into a thing where this is happening all over the world? Who knows who killed whom, when, how?
Well, it is already happening around the world. Our war on terror has in many respects become terror's war on the world. They can strike from New York to Bali to Madrid to Nigeria to anywhere else. And so the world has to have a capability for responding, for detecting, disrupting, tracking these networks. And the New York Times article, I think, does a good job of trying to point out how intelligence is a critical element in this form of irregular warfare, so much so that it's right up alongside the fellas pulling the triggers. And that clip from Zero Dark Thirty is all about the intelligence that guided people to the site where they had to go. These things can't be separated anymore as they could in earlier eras.
Nick Kulish, the one-time snipers, the Black Squadron operatives in SEAL Team 6, you report pushed working more and more in intelligence gathering, and not just men, women also.
Yeah, I have to say that was one of the more surprising revelations for us. I mean, the women they're not going through the BUDS training that all would-be Navy SEALs have to go through, and they're not going through the same green team selection process as the men to get into SEAL Team 6. But they are I think a critical part of what's being done in intelligence. You know, you need to be able to present different faces. You can't, as discussed earlier, if you're sending in a 250-pound, tattooed guy in a ball cap and cargo mm-hmm. pants, people might guess who that is. You're now seeing women working alongside them.
Don in Spokane, Washington. Don, thank you for calling. You're on.
Hi, I was in Central Highlands as a liaison officer to a CIA operation where we kidnapped and assassinated people called Operation Phoenix.
You're talking Vietnam War era, Don.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And basically, one of the SEAL 10-6 people said what they did to Osama bin Laden was nothing new. They did that all the time. They go in, they kick open a door, they go and murder a couple of people, and they fly off. It was nothing but when we did it in Vietnam, it was I was proud of it at one time, but I see it now as nothing but attacking a bunch of innocent people and giving them terror. It's just nothing but terror. I'm not proud of this operation at all.
Innocent people? What if it's Taliban? What if it's Islamic State? What if it's Al-Qaeda operatives who would...
That's what you say.
Well, I mean, I'm asking.
That's what you say.
I'm asking.
Well, I know what we did. We did it to a bunch of farmers that were just simply trying to be VC, and we'd go in and kill them. We'd dress up our people as North Vietnamese. Actually, we used North Vietnamese, the regular North Vietnamese that joined our side or quit,
yep,
or we captured.
Yep.
And we'd go and murder innocent people, and this is all it is. It's just another, it's so wonderful. We're killing people. We're so proud of killing people all the time. I'm tired of it.
Don, we've got it. John Arquilla, what do you say to that? The Vietnam vet experience.
Yeah, the caller speaks to an important point, and it's a debate within the special operations community about the emphasis between what's called direct action and where these commando-type raids and what's called unconventional warfare, where our guys actually go and work and live with the locals and help them to fight against the insurgents or the terrorists. And in Vietnam, there was plenty of that as well, with Special Forces A-teams living with Montagnard and Mayo tribesmen. And there was quite a bit of that going on in Afghanistan, but I think there, I get a sense from the caller of impatience with the amount of this direct action, and I too think there could be an adjustment that balances the equilibrium a bit, and we do more of the unconventional warfare working by, with, and through locals. That's what's led to our great success in Anbar province in 2007 and 2008. We're going to have to rekindle something like that if Iraq's going to get better again, and we're going to have to do something like that again in Afghanistan if we're going to return the equilibrium there.
New York Times quotes a retired SEAL Team 6 member saying, "War is not this pretty thing that the United States has come to believe it to be." He says, the retired SEAL, "It's emotional, one human being killing another human being for extended periods of time. It's going to bring out the worst in you. It's also going to bring out the best in you." Alexis in Albany, New York. Alexis, you're on.
Hello. I want to add another perspective to this, mm-hmm. which this is perfect timing with the last call. One of my friends was a medic, and he rode with the SEAL teams on the night raids. And what they would do is break down the doors and go in, and he would treat people medically. So some of those night raids were for show, and actually were beneficial to the people and also resulted in weapons caches being turned over.
But they weren't just going out to bring first aid to people. Mm-hmm. They weren't just going out to bring medical treatment to people, I assume, right?
They were doing a combination of both. So they would learn about maybe somebody who has a child who has some deformity or some issue that could be handled with a minor procedure. And they would actually go in, do a raid on that home, and treat the child medically. And in some cases, those were families of insurgents. So in one case, I know there was an uncle of an insurgent, and the uncle ended up giving up a location of weapons caches because they helped his son.
Alexis, I appreciate your call. Well, thank you. One more right here from Virginia Beach, Virginia. Of course, that is home of headquarters of SEAL Team 6. Tracy, thanks for calling.
Hi. I just want to say I've heard lots of different opinions. The SEALs are my neighbors, my friends. They don't take their jobs lightly, what they have to do. And we are proud of our SEALs in this military town. When they took out Osama bin Laden, every restaurant, every place had a sign up saying, we're proud of our SEAL Team 6. That's all.
Tracy, I appreciate your call. John Arquilla, do we have the right balance here? We need effective fighting forces. On the other hand, you don't want to overuse. Our caller, Vietnam caller, says it's possible to slip into, you know, real misuse. You don't want to do either of those things. How do you see the balance now, John?
Well, we're slowly moving away from the overuse of our elites in sort of regular raiding operations. We need to have more of the conventional forces capable in these areas. The previous caller who mentioned about the medical interventions, that's very important. A lot of those night raids took place without a shot being fired, and a great deal of intelligence was gathered. We can't win our wars with drones, Tom. Very simply, a drone strike doesn't allow you the opportunity to gain intelligence on the ground. For example, a few weeks ago, there was a Ranger raid that killed the oil man of ISIS.
Yes.
You can bet that they got a huge amount of intelligence at the same time because they were on site. So we need this. We need to use it skillfully, more sparingly, absolutely no doubt about that. But let's face it, we blew $1 trillion in Afghanistan and Iraq, respectively. Would you rather spend that kind of money and lose the thousands of lives and shatter the tens of thousands of lives of those campaigns? Or would you rather work more skillfully, more surgically, with a stiletto, not a broadsword?
This is the question that Americans are perhaps going to increasingly be asked. The New York Times lays out the elements of the operations broadly in their very big piece, which ran yesterday. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Nicholas Kulish, one of the reporters on that piece. Nick, thank you very much for being with us today.
Appreciate it, Tom.
Jeffrey Korn, retired U.S. Army Lieutenant Colonel, professor of criminal military law at the South Texas School of Law. Jeffrey Korn, thanks to you for your time and insights.
Thanks for having me.
And John Arquilla at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey. John, thank you as always.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.